This is Central Time. In 2007, a challenge was issued by the XPRIZE Foundation. Here it is. Build a mass-producible car that could travel 100 miles on the equivalent of a gallon of gas. The reward, $10 million. Hundreds of teams took up the challenge. Many of them were amateurs.
And our next guest has chronicled some of the stories of the teams who vied for the prize, teams that built cars that threw away long-held ideas about what an automobile should be. And he says their story is one of true American ingenuity.
Joining us now is Jason Fagoni. He's the author of Ingenious, a true story of invention, automotive daring, and the race to revive America. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So first, set the stage for us. What is the Automotive X Prize?
So the Automotive X Prize was a $10 million competition to create the super-efficient car of the future. And it was launched in 2007 by a nonprofit foundation in California that was just frustrated with the status quo in the automotive industry. We've had very little progress on fuel efficiency in about 100 years. The Model T, Ford Model T, got about 20 miles to the gallon, and the average vehicle today gets about 25. So there's been very little progress, and this foundation said, we can do better. This is insane. This is a very creative country. There are a lot of ingenious people here. And so they put out a call. They said, if you can make a 100-mile-per-gallon car that gets 200 miles of range, we will give you $10 million. And it didn't matter who you were or what you'd done before or how much money you had in your pocket. If you solved the problem, you got the money. And hundreds of teams from all over the world responded to this challenge, and they were not big companies for the most part. They were small teams, entrepreneurs, startups, students, and they all came in with better ideas.
We'll hear some of their stories in a minute, but first I wanted to ask about your story. In the intro to your book, you say you're not a car guy, so why does this car contest spark your interest?
Yeah, I'm not at all. For most of the time I was reporting this book, I was driving a 2002 Honda Accord with about 120,000 miles on it. And, you know, I think I'm like most people in that when I get in my car, I don't want to think about it too much. I basically want to turn the key and have it work. I don't have a lot of patience for crazy engineering or radical design. I just expect it to work. But, you know, the contest captivated me because I found out about it in 2010. And in 2010, you know, it was a pretty dark time in America. The big banks had all failed. General Motors and Chrysler had gone bankrupt. And it just seemed like all of the kind of the big guys in America had let us down. The elites had failed. And the idea of the contest was that we needed to broaden our idea of what an inventor is and look for solutions in other places. So all of these little guys with big ideas were entering and said they could do better, and I wanted to see if they could. I wanted to see if these little guys with big ideas could solve a problem that Detroit had refused to solve.
So give us a sense of the kinds of people who turned out to enter cars in this contest.
Sure. One of my favorite teams was Illuminati Motor Works, which was basically a 39-year-old dude from central Illinois who decided to build an electric car with his friends and his wife and his father. He was a state employee. He worked for the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, and he hated his job, so he spent most of his time at work sort of daydreaming about projects that he could work on in the barn behind his house. And he heard about this contest, and he thought that he could win it by building an electric car by hand. So he set out to literally build an electric car with his bare hands. He went to a scrapyard near his house, bought a bunch of lengths of steel, forged them in a wood-burning stove in the barn behind his house, melted the steel around plywood forms, and then welded these lengths of steel together to form the skeleton of this car. You know how if you see in automobile commercials these robots that weld cars together? This car was essentially welded together by hand by one guy. And in the skeleton of the car, he put parts that he had scavenged from junkyards. And around the parts that he had scavenged from junkyards, he built a custom super aerodynamic body for the car, also by hand, out of foam, epoxy, and fiberglass. And he did all of that because he had to build it from scratch because there wasn't an existing car that he could adapt that was aerodynamic and efficient enough to get to 100 miles per gallon. He had to start start with a blank sheet of paper. And when I first saw this car, I admit I did not want to sit in it. I did not want to drive it. I did not believe in it. It looked like kind of like a dead fingernail because of the color of the epoxy. But, I underestimated them. They ended up performing incredibly well in the competition. I only chose to follow them because I thought they were an interesting kind of human interest story. A husband and wife building an electric car in a barn. But they surprised everybody, including me.
Well, you reference Mark Twain in your book and his idea of a nation of inventors. And man, this guy is like Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court, kind of. He really epitomized that Mark Twain inventor ideal that you mentioned.
Yeah, I love that comparison. That's great. I think we've gotten away from the original idea of the inventor in this culture. I think when you think of an inventor who has influence in the culture today, you probably think of, a coder in Silicon Valley, maybe. Or maybe you think of Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla Motors, who is a very brilliant and creative guy. But he also made a fortune in the dot-com era. Inventors today who have influence in the culture are rich elites. And it didn't used to be this way. Mark Twain said, "We are called the nation of inventors, and we are." And Walt Whitman wrote beautiful poetry about engineers and mechanics. And Thomas Jefferson designed the patent system so that ordinary people would be able to protect their ideas. And I think what excited all these guys about invention was the democracy of it, the idea that we all have these innate Promethean powers, and we can use them to create, and we can design a country to unleash them. And I think we've gotten away from that idea over the years, but I don't think it's too late to go back to it. And I think the XPRIZE and competitions like this are proof, because it really was an eruption of incredible creative energy and flourishing in a very dark time, and it came from nowhere. So I think if we broaden our idea of what an inventor is and where important ideas are allowed to come from, we can really tap much broader potential in this country.
We're talking to Jason Fagoni. His new book is Ingenious, and he looked at the Automotive XPRIZE, stories of people trying to build the cars of the future. We'll hear some more of their stories coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with Jason Fagoni about the Automotive XPRIZE. He writes about it in his new book, Ingenious. It's the quest to build the car of the future and, he says, rekindle the spirit of invention and inventors in the United States. Jason, another team that I wanted to talk about, you followed them, the West Philly Hybrid X team. Tell us about who was involved in that.
Sure. West Philadelphia Hybrid X team. I work in Philadelphia, and in early 2010, I heard about some students and teachers who make super efficient hybrid cars at a high school in a poor section of West Philly. And I thought that was interesting, so I went over to see them. And when I walked into their garage, it was this old-fashioned place, all the machines and signs right out of the 50s. But then the kids were building these wild futuristic hybrids. And a lot of these kids are not high achieving on standardized tests, but if you give them a manual and a transmission and a free Saturday, they can take apart a transmission in no time flat. And they had actually beaten MIT in a number of similar fuel efficiency competitions, and they had beaten MIT already in the XPRIZE. So I wanted to follow them because, number one, I was interested in their cars. Their cars were adaptations. They weren't built from scratch. They were designed to be low-cost vehicles, the kinds of vehicles that the kids could see their moms driving. One of them was a sort of like a Chevy Volt on the cheap. It was an adaptation of a Ford Focus, a 2008 Ford Focus. They had taken out the engine, and they had put in a hybrid drive of their own design. It was very ingenious. It was the gasoline component was a Harley-Davidson V-twin motorcycle engine that was married to an electric motor, and that's never been done before in a hybrid. A Harley has never been in a hybrid, much less in a hybrid based on a Ford Focus. It was like the loudest hybrid ever made in the world. It growled, it growled like a Harley. Both of the systems were connected to the transmission by means of a magnetic clutch that was salvaged from a farm tractor. And the first time I saw this thing, it was up on benches. It looked like a piece of outsider art or something. But it was very efficient, and it worked really well. And the kids did incredibly well in the competition. They made it to the semifinals, and they ended up beating a team from Cornell.
What kind of mileage are we talking here in a car made by students struggling in high school? What kind of mileage did they come up with?
They came up with, I think, 63.5 miles per gallon equivalents on their hybrid, which is pretty good. It's better than a Prius. And, their car was necessarily kind of heavy because they didn't have the money to do extreme lightweighting that some of the other teams had done. So 63.5 miles per gallon with a 3,000-pound Ford Focus is excellent. And they would have gotten much more, only they had made a small mistake with a minor part of their system that they had overlooked at the last minute because they ran out of time. But it's still a pretty incredible achievement.
Now, they lost the event, and this was a few years ago, but you've kept following the teams you focused on. What is this high school team, this high school car design team, what have they done since?
Sure. So they went to an event called the Green Grand Prix in New York the year following the XPRIZE, 2011. They raced against a Chevy Volt and a number of other efficient cars, and they won it flat. Came in first place. I believe they got 120 miles per gallon equivalent with one of their cars. They went back to the Green Grand Prix in 2012, and they won it again. So, they're a monster. They're a hugely competitive team, and the XPRIZE, if anything, the fact that they didn't win it is an anomaly in their history. But a number of other teams have continued to work on their cars after the prize, and that's one of the reasons why I kept following them for 4 years. I didn't just follow them during the prize in 2010. I stuck with it because I wanted to see what their cars would be able to do. There was a team called the Edison 2 out of Lynchburg, Virginia. They were run by a fiery, passionate German named Oliver Kuttner. And Oliver Kuttner's story was that he, as a kid, he had always wanted to be a professional race car driver, but he eventually he got too fat to be able to fit into the slim cockpits of the race cars. So he became obsessed with the opposite idea, the idea of lightness. He believed in this dictum of Henry Ford. Henry Ford once said, "The most beautiful things in life are those from which all excess weight has been eliminated." And Oliver believed that with religious devotion. He believed that cars had become too heavy, too bloated, that the fact that we're all driving around these 3,000-pound vehicles is a catastrophe. And he set about to make a very light car. And in fact, he called it that, the very light car. And it was so light, ultimately, that you could push it across the floor with your thumb.
Wow.
The very light car was so light and so efficient that it was able to get 102.5 miles per gallon equivalent in the XPRIZE while using a small internal combustion engine. It was burning ethanol and gasoline.
And you write that he got that weight by rethinking every part, right, even down to the lug nuts of this car to try to strip away weight.
Exactly. I mean, the first time I met him, he asked me to hold out my hand, and he put a small piece of metal in my hand, and he started grinning. I looked down, I was holding a lug nut, which is, as you know, is the most humble part of a car. It holds the wheel onto a car. I didn't understand why he was grinning so maniacally about this lug nut. He was so proud of it. And I came to understand that he was so proud of it because the lug nut weighed from 3 to 10 times at less than a normal lug nut. He had made a custom lug nut. He had gone to the trouble of making a custom lug nut just to save a couple of ounces across the weight of the car. And what he wanted me to understand was that he is such a maniac about lightness that he would go to that length just to save a couple of ounces. And of course, he had not just reinvented the lug nut, but he had reinvented every other part of the car.
So the goal of this prize was to come up with something that could be marketed, maybe picked up by the existing car companies. By those terms, has the Automotive XPRIZE been successful?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by practical. I think that there was a sort of a tension built into the prize. The tension was between creativity and practicality. So the cars, according to the rules of the prize, the cars had to be safe and practical. They had to accelerate in a certain way. They had to do a double lane change maneuver. They had to brake within a certain distance. They had to be like normal cars. but they didn't have to be crash tested like normal cars, and they didn't have to conform to all of the safety standards of normal cars. And the reason for that was that the XPRIZE wanted to create some room for creativity. They wanted to create somewhat of an artificial world where the usual rules didn't apply. And they wanted to do that because the normal rules have created this catastrophe of almost no progress on fuel efficiency in a century. So they wanted to try to break out of that. So I think the result was that a lot of the cars ended up looking a little weird because they had to look weird to achieve these efficiencies. And I think a lot of people looked at these weird-looking cars and said, well, these cars aren't practical. I guess I would say that weird is in the eye of the beholder. You know, weird cars have succeeded before. The Volkswagen Beetle, the original Beetle, was a very weird-looking car. But it was well-made and fun and efficient, and it met a need. And eventually the Beetle became a design icon. So, you know, weird also changes as the world changes, I think. You know, it's increasingly weird to me that we go to a gas station with a 3,000-pound vehicle and put flammable liquid into it, you know, by the gallon. It's weird to know that, you know, every gallon you burn, you're putting 20 pounds of carbon dioxide into an atmosphere that is increasingly saturated with it. You're literally warming the planet by a tiny increment every time you drive.
All right, Jason, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us to tell these stories today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That's Jason Fagone. He's the author of Ingenious, a true story of invention, automotive daring, and the race to revive America.
Early Sunday morning, the U.S. and five other world powers came to an unprecedented nuclear agreement with Iran. Iran will restrict its uranium enrichment to a level used for non-military production in exchange for easing some of the economic sanctions.
The agreement has a deadline of 6 months, during which further negotiations are expected. The deal has been met with praise and skepticism, with harsh criticism coming from Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Here with us to talk about the details of the agreement and what we can expect in the coming months is Politico's Deputy White House Editor Rebecca Cinderbrand. Rebecca, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the agreement is being called historic. How significant is it, do you think?
Oh, it's extremely significant. You know, this is marking, it's easy to remember that just a few short months ago, it had been more than three decades since the two leaders of the United States and Iran had spoken with each other. And now there's an actual diplomatic agreement that's been reached. Granted, it's only an interim agreement, but of course, the administration pointing to it as the first step to a more permanent resolution to the problem.
So you mentioned the six-month deal. It was reached. What does it have to say about Iran's capability to develop nuclear weapons now and in the future?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things that are in it, and there's a couple of things that are still seem to be, at least at this moment, a little fuzzy and are still being resolved. Right now, what it says is Iran is going to agree to stop producing this sort of enriched uranium that basically represents the best effort to produce weapons-grade material, and it's also going to stop developing new centrifuges, which you know, can produce fuel for a nuclear weapon. It's going to agree not to install critical components or fuel at its reactor at Iraq, which could produce enough plutonium for two weapons a year if it were operational, and it's going to neutralize its medium-enriched nuclear fuel and agree to some inspections. And in return, the Western powers have agreed not to impose new sanctions for the next 6 months if Iran abides by the commitment, and to allow Iran access to some of its reserves that have been frozen overseas.
And critics of this, you know, are saying, well, this is not the whole goal. We had wanted, you know, for instance, Israel saying we'd wanted more out of this. You haven't gone far enough. What is the United States saying about the six-month plan and maybe getting further along the pike with this?
Well, there's a couple of things here. Number one is, of course, the president can ask Congress and make the case to Congress that new sanctions shouldn't be imposed. But, of course, that's exactly what was in progress before this agreement was announced. There was discussion in Congress, even in the days leading up to this agreement's announcement, of the possibility of even stronger sanctions than the ones already in place. And that's a discussion that continues, even in the wake of this agreement. So, you know, the president and the administration have to make the case to both allies and critics on Capitol Hill that now is not the time to impose new restrictions on Iran, that they need to let the process develop.
And President Obama did not have to go to Congress to ask for permission on this because he can keep his side of the bargain through an executive order. Do you know what would have happened had he gone to Congress at this point?
Well, of course, that is the question. Again, looking at the way things were going in the direction that things were heading in, Congress, of course, discussing additional sanctions. And even now, we're expecting to see some sort of action, whether it's in the form of hearings, whether it's in the form of a call from Congress for additional oversight. There's discussions on Capitol Hill. And, of course, while the president has said to Congress, again, now is not the time for new sanctions, it technically is within the purview of Congress. They could start discussing that. He doesn't, you know, they don't have to ask his permission for that. Of course, you know, the key thing to keep in mind as well is the timeline here. This, for the first time, sets up a kind of deadline, if you will, where if there are critics on the Hill that can make the case that Iran has not complied with the terms of the agreement, the pressure for additional action becomes even stronger.
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry has said this was not an agreement based on trust, but on verification. Others have said, in essence, you know, we just sort of need to see how this plays out. What does that mean?
Well, what Kerry's saying is, look, Iran has agreed to kind of an unprecedented access, at least for Iran, to inspectors. That has agreed to daily inspections of some weapon sites and other measures which would allow for verification. You know, the president and others saying, look, we understand. The White House releasing a statement yesterday also saying, look, we understand Israel has reason to be skeptical of Iran's intentions here, that others have reason to be skeptical of Iran's intentions. And so verification and the inspections by international inspectors and the allowing the access for international inspectors is a big part of this agreement, and that's something you can expect to see the administration pointing to many, many times in the weeks and months ahead.
Now, we just heard in the top of the hour headlines from NPR that Israel will be sending delegates to Washington to talk about what they'd like going forward with Iran as they move forward looking at a deeper nuclear deal. Do you have a sense of what they'll be asking for and what their priorities are?
Of course, you know, the president spoke to Prime Minister Netanyahu on Sunday after the agreement was announced. The Prime Minister, of course, speaking out before he and the president had connected, expressing his disappointment with the deal. This is not what he wanted to see in the slightest. The president also said, made it clear, and the administration made it clear, that that communication with Israel about disagreement, the terms of the agreement, the inspections under the agreement was going to be continuous now that it had been announced. You know, these talks, we're now learning, of course, were going on for many, many months, even before there was public awareness that they were taking place, that the process had begun. And so apparently, you know, Israel came to some awareness of this, they were saying. Representatives of the Israeli government were saying that they'd come to some awareness of this, even though it was not revealed to them officially for some time.
Now, this deal has an expiration date of 6 months. You know, in the meantime, what kind of oversight will weapons inspectors have in Iran?
Again, that's the key. You know, under the terms of this agreement, there would be at some point daily inspections involved. There will be access for international inspectors, and they will be given free access to the two reactors in particular that were in question. And that's going to be a huge, huge part of the president and the administration's case as they're heading to Congress now. You heard John Kerry say it's trust and verify, 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 repeating that again and again and again, making the case that the administration is not just taking Iran's word on faith, that it is looking at actual facts on the ground, that there are experts there who are able to gauge whether or not Tehran is in compliance with the terms of the agreement. Because, again, the key for the administration is not just looking ahead to the possibility of a permanent agreement in 6 months, but preventing any additional action from being taken before then. Anything that happens before then, any additional measures that were taken, any punitive measures against Iran, they say would weaken their hand when they go to the negotiating table because it would make the case to Tehran that they might not be able to deliver on their side of any kind of permanent agreement.
And it's possible, isn't it, that this could just draw out 6 months by 6 months, eking along without maybe ever getting as far as certain parties would like it to go?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's the other key here. But of course, you know, a lot of people saying, the people who are defending the agreement would say, look, you know, at least there's a process in place now, and that any kind of continuing diplomatic process, even if it's slow and painful, will be preferable to military action. And, of course, some critics worrying that the momentum could be lost for stronger action if there is this kind of slow, painful movement forward that's apparent. It's interesting, so we'll see how it plays out over the next few months. The dynamic that develops, the sense of whether Iran is being completely forthcoming, the sense of whether inspectors have all the access that they need to verify that Iran is in compliance, that's going to be a huge part of what we can expect to see at the end of the six-month period.
Well, obviously the brass ring here is an Iran without weapons capabilities, whose program is only used for peaceful purposes. How close do you think we are to grabbing that ring at this point?
And that's the $64,000 question. I mean, you know, no one seems to really know that. Again, even the administration, as it's plugging this deal and saying that they're going to be moving forward and continuing the conversation with Iranian officials, saying, again, Israel and others have much reason to be skeptical of Iran's stated intentions. So the early signs, or at least, you know, the fact that Iran has agreed to halt the production of the weapons-grade uranium is seen as a huge step, or at least a sign of good faith. So at least for the time being, for the next several months, that program is essentially frozen in place, which the administration believes will be the case, or at the very least it will slow down their progression towards weapons. So, again, remains to be seen.
All right. Well, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Rebecca Cinderbrand, Deputy White House Editor for Politico. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
In October of 2005, neuroscientist James Fallon was searching through brain scans of psychopaths and other abnormal brains when he made a surprising discovery.
Until then, Fallon believed that our genes mainly determine our behavior. What he found that day muddied the waters a bit.
James Fallon joins us now. His new book is called The Psychopath Inside, a neuroscientist's personal journey into the dark side of the brain. James is a professor of psychiatry and human behavior at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine. And James, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Veronica.
You've been looking at brain scans as part of your research, in particular the brains of serial killers, in this instance, psychopaths, and a handful of other abnormal brain types. What does the brain of a psychopath look like?
Well, the consistent underlying pattern looks like, and it's not just from those that I had been studying and reported on, but recently other people have found the same thing. And so far it looks like it's a reduction of activity, neural activity, in the part of the prefrontal cortex over the eyes. It's called orbital because it's over the orbits, and also called ventromedial. That's all right next to each other. And also there was a lower activity in the amygdala at the end of the temporal lobe. And these two connect to make a big C in the brain of structures. And this is the emotional brain or limbic system. And these were all pretty much turned off. And in addition, the area, another part connecting them, called the insula, showed a patchiness that was very abnormal, and that has to do with that area has to do with empathy. So it's those areas of the brain that are involved in ethics, morality, controls of impulse, but also kind of your animal desires and your the type of empathy you have or don't have. Those areas were really abnormal in all these psychopaths and many of the murderers.
And so you see a brain like that, you see these areas of the brain that are maybe shut down, and you think, okay, this is a profile of the brain of a psychopath, right?
Well, it's the profile of the brain of somebody who probably has those traits. And so people who have this pattern may not be psychopaths, but they probably will have the traits of the impulsivity, kind of devil may care. They will lack a certain kind of empathy. That is, they'll have many of the traits, but perhaps without being a categorical a psychopath. And so, I mean, if you see this pattern, and when I've seen it in people, you can kind of tell how they behave, but it doesn't mean you can't tell they're a criminal, and you can't tell they're a categorical psychopath, but you know some of their behaviors for sure.
All right. Well, and some of these people include, you, as a matter of fact. You were looking through these and you got a shock. Tell us what happened.
Well, you know, I guess in everybody's life, Gandalf shows up at the door and plays a trick. And the problem is I played a trick on myself. It was purely by serendipity. And as I was at the end of analyzing all these murderers' brains and psychopaths and was starting to give talks, I just happened to be doing a parallel study in the lab on genes that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. And we had finished all the patients, and we were looking for controls, more controls. And we're doing genetic studies and the PET scans. And so I asked my family if they want to be involved because we needed normals. And but also we hadn't done a family, and especially my wife's mother and father died of Alzheimer's. She had a lot of it in the family. And so I asked her, do you really want to know? And, you know, maybe you don't want to know if you have the genetics and the beginning patterns of this, even though you're normal now. And she said yes. And this was a key thing that happened. And, I, you know, in a way, I don't know if I wish she would have said yes, because this opened up everything. So I blame this on her, basically. You know, so so we did it. And the scans came back, and I went through them. And I had a pile of all the murder scans and psychopaths on the table on my office. And the technicians brought the scans in. They said, here's your family scans. There's a whole pile of them. And I looked through very quickly. You know, we had it coded so there were no names on anything. I like to do these blindly. Normal. And I was so relieved. I got through, you know, all the way through the pile just about. And everybody looked normal. It didn't look like Alzheimer's, because I've seen a lot of Alzheimer's patients' brains and PET scans. But I got to the last one, and I flipped it over. And I said, and I told the technician, I said, this one is in the wrong pile. This should be in the murderers pile. It's clearly mislabeled. And they went back to the PET machine and rechecked and rechecked. They come back, no, it's your family. I mean, at that point, I had to tear off the label. And it was me. And it was, the technician and I looked at each other. We just started to laugh. We kind of got the joke. And it was on me, but I just kind of laughed it off and really didn't get the rest of the genetics done for a while, because we were so busy with the adult stem cell company I was setting up and these other studies. I kind of laughed it off because I thought to myself, I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a killer, or rapist. After I got the genetic studies, the same thing came back. I had like 15 of the genes that are associated with aggression and violence in psychopathy, as well as many of the 15 or so ones related to low empathy.
And then did you start to put it together a little bit and say, you know, maybe I do have some of these traits?
Well, Veronica, after the genes came back, I had two parts of the biology were there. You know, there was a brain connectivity pattern that was associated with psychopathy, clearly, and the genetics. But still, I didn't take it seriously until, you know, I work with a lot of psychiatrists and who know me intimately in my behavior and geneticists. And we went through everything, and I started to ask them. I said, I'm not a psychopath, am I? Then the floodgates opened up. And they said, well, we've been telling you for many years that your behavior is psychopathic. And, you know, Veronica, I just said, well, that's like when somebody calls you crazy, you kind of blow it off, you're crazy. You know, you laugh it off. But they said, over the years, they listed all of these things I had done, and they agreed that I had all these psychopathic behaviors. I never was listening to this, because I didn't see it all at once.
You know, so they made the case that, yeah, in fact, you did exhibit some of these behaviors that psychopaths have. But on the other hand, you've never murdered anybody. You're not a rapist. So why do some people have that brain and those genes, and they go out and they murder somebody, and why didn't you?
Well, this is a great question. What in thinking about this, I finally was sitting in my jacuzzi. My mother was here. She's like 96 at the time. She's 90. And she was, you know, pruning our plant. She loves to do that in the garden. And she was sitting on this three-legged stool. And I looked at it, and I looked at her, and I said, Jesus, that's it. Now, you know, my life growing up in my family was incredibly good. And I looked at my mother, and, you know, and I realized that she had before me and after me, like 7 or 8 miscarriages. So after my brother, my oldest brother, was born, it was like 5 years, then I was born, and then 4 more years before the next one. So I was like the next brother. And I was the middle of this, so I was always treated like the golden child. And I was by not only my parents and siblings, but also by my aunts and uncles and grandparents and their friends. It was just quite extraordinary. And you could see it in all the pictures. And I went back and looked at the movies. I was happy as a lark. And it was because of, you know, the way I was treated. And
you were loved.
I was absolutely loved. And I think My mother instinctively knew that. She also saw me at right at the time, and she just told me this. This was just a year and a half ago. I was writing the book, so this is something quite surprised me. And she told me that I went through this extraordinary dark period around puberty. And she was going to get a psychiatrist for me and all this, tell my father, but she didn't. I think she just told my teachers and other people to watch this guy, you know, make sure he doesn't get into trouble and everything. But, you know, Veronica, frankly, I was like, I'm, you know, 6 foot. I was athletic, like 210 pounds, and really got along with people. And so I was very social and athletic, and nobody ever bothered me anyway. And so I, you know, I was never subjected to anything that could be considered bullying or abuse. And I said, that's it. I said, I have all these genes, and I found out I had another allele for a serotonin transporter, that, and this was a, another key, that, and that I write about in the book because it was so important, that I have this one, and it was thought to be one of these warrior genes that put you at risk for violence and everything. But that's only if you're subjected to early abandonment or abuse, especially in the first few years of life.
So to cut to the chase, long story short, it's not necessarily just our brains and our genes. It's the environment.
Yeah, this was embarrassing for me, you know, personally, because I had been like the poster boy to my colleagues about being, genes are everything. And I had to eat crow. I had it wrong. And once I saw how genes and environment and the timing of it in specific ways, it turned me upside down. So it was embarrassing professionally, but enlightening for me. And sometimes you got to just, you know, eat it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's a fascinating story. James, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking to James Fallon, professor of psychiatry, and his new book is called The Psychopath Inside, A Neuroscientist's Personal Journey into the Dark Side of the Brain.